Lux Occult is a part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network. Lux Occult.
A stranger has come to share my room in the house not right in the head. A girl mad as birds, bolting the night of the door with her arm, her plume, straight in the mazed bed. She deludes the heaven-proof house with entering clouds, yet she deludes with walking the nightmarish room at large as the dead, or rides the imagined oceans of the male wards. She has come possessed. Who admits the delusive light through the bouncing wall? Possessed by the skies, she sleeps in the narrow through, yet she walks the dust, yet raves at her will. On the madhouse boards worn thin by my walking tears, and taken by light in her arms at long and dear last, I may without fail suffer the first vision that set fire to the stars. That was Love in the Asylum by Dylan Thomas. Hello and welcome to Lux Occult. This is the podcast where we gleefully taunt the mundane, butcher the Latin and most other languages, and we also discuss a variety of occult topics, exploring the intersections of magic, art, science, philosophy, technology, and so much more through the lens of chaos magic. This is occultism for everyone. I'm your host, Lux Estrada, and if you're hearing the sound of my voice right now, that means that this show, and magic for that matter, are for you if you want them. There are a lot of different ways to be more free, and using magic or making space for a spiritual practice in your life can be one of them. As always, I don't speak for anybody but myself. Others can, will, and should disagree with me sometimes. How would we ever learn anything if we're all agreeing all the time after all? And like those who attempt to be reasonable should, I'm willing to revise my opinions, and often do, based on new evidence. So spooky season continues here on the Lux Occult podcast. I'm super stoked to be sharing a very rad conversation I had with Jason Miller, author of the new book Consorting with Spirits. Jason is the author of many other titles and is a holder of various occult accolades as well. You can check out his work at strategicsorcery.net. So we talk about the book and what goes into the work of consorting with spirits in one's practice. Some of the topics explored are how should we frame our thinking when it comes to issues like consent and everything when dealing with non-corporeal entities, and ways of contextualizing the information we obtain via spiritual contact and divination and things like that. We also discuss the concept of self-sovereignty and talk about one of the biggest dangers of magic. There is a lot of great practical advice to be found in this one for sure. In a slight departure from the format I've been going with lately, there will not be an episode within the episode in this one. Instead, I'm going to talk a little bit about my own recent experiments in consorting with spirits. While making my latest album, I conceived of a way to try to create haunted objects using sound magic. And if everything goes according to plan, this episode should be published around the same time as the album, hopefully a little bit before the album. So I'm excited about it. We will hear some listener mail, some Green Mushroom Project updates, some sound magic tracks, poetry snacks, and much more. But before we go any further, I would like to say thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate you taking the time to hang out with my guests and I here on this show. I'm super lucky to have such really fucking rad listeners, collaborators, co-conspirators, you have it. You really are the best, I appreciate y'all. I've been using social media a lot less lately, but that does not mean that I do not want to interact with you or hear from you all. I always welcome people's questions, thoughts, comments, suggestions, arcane revelations, and what have you, and you can reach me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com, or you can hit me up on Instagram at luxoccultpod. So if you are into the show and you like the other stuff I'm doing, you can support me on Patreon. If you do so, you are entitled to take a bibliomancy break with me. And there's no tiers or levels or anything like that. So you can give as you will. There's a few other bonus things up there as well. And I'm hoping to be adding some more to that just as a way of saying thank you also, because I really do appreciate it. Your support definitely makes the show possible and making it means a lot. So thank you. Shout out to everybody on the Green Machine, is what we're calling it for the time being, Discord server. You can find the Green Mushroom Project and Edministrism there, and there's all kinds of just general magic channels as well for folks that aren't really that into either one of those projects but just want to hang around and shoot the shit and talk about magic or whatever else. It's a very chill group of practitioners. So if you are interested in coming and kicking it with us or participating in the book club or the group rituals, experiments, other fun things like weekly chats, what have you, hit me up and I will get you a link. Okay, so as I mentioned, my guest, Jason Miller's new book is called Consorting with Spirits. We talk about how this was the name of a crime you could be charged with in history. And so it felt fitting for me to mention another book along these lines, which is The Malus Maleficarum. So this was several hundred years ago, but it was as recently as the 1980s that the same type of thinking was in play, at least in mainstream American media, with the satanic panic of that time. And as we've seen in recent years with things like QAnon, we're coming back around to it again. So if people are curious about this, I would suggest they check out the Occult Confessions podcast for some of their coverage on the topic. There's some good stuff in there that I think it's good to be aware of as occultists or whatever you want to call yourself. Anyway, what I'd like to point out about the passage I'm about to read to you about the Malus Maleficarum, which is from an article called A Brief History of Witchcraft Persecutions Before Salem on the site Famous Trials by Professor Douglas Olinder. The thing that I wanted to point out is that it's totally nothing new for people to take their own strange and often pretty deviant fantasies and project them onto people who they are oftentimes in the process of actively marginalizing. So I wonder if there's some kind of like unacknowledged discomfort or guilt with the situation that causes people to do this weird projection thing in the first place. I have no fucking clue. Anyway, let's hear about the Hammer of Witches. Okay, so this is 1484, and this is what Professor Douglas Linder has written about it. Pope Innocent announced that Satanists in Germany were meeting with demons, casting spells that destroyed crops, and aborting infants. The Pope asked two friars, Heinrich Kramer, who was a papal inquisitor of sorcerers from Isenbruck, and Jacob Spranger, to publish a full report on the suspected witchcraft. 2 years later, the friars published Malus Maleficarum, or Hammer of Witches, which put to rest the old orthodoxy that witches were powerless in the face of God, to a new orthodoxy that held that Christians had an obligation to hunt them down and kill them. The Malus told frightening tales of women who would have sex with any convenient demon, kill babies, and even steal penises. The friars asked, "What is to be thought of those witches who collect as many as 20 or 30 members together and put them in a bird's nest or shut them up in a box where they move themselves like living members and eat oats and corn?" Over the next 40 years, the Malus would be reprinted 13 times and come to help define the crime of witchcraft. Much of the book offered hints to judges and prosecutors, such as the author's suggestion to strip each suspect completely and inspect the body to see whether a mole was present that might be a telltale sign of consort with demons, and to have the defendants brought into court backwards to minimize their opportunities to cast dangerous spells on officials. Okay, so thank you, Professor Douglas Linder, for that. All right, so what do we think is going on here with this? It certainly seems like pretty gross abuse of power to me. Also, this is some pretty fucking unhinged shit. But it used to be, like, used as a legal document, or at least something adjacent to it. So I'm curious, though. I've been playing around with magic for a while now, and I have yet to master some of these tricks that are mentioned here, but perhaps you all have fared better. Do you have as many as 20 or 30 dicks that you've stolen and put together and then put them in a bird's nest or shut them in a box where they move by themselves like living members and eat oats and corn? If so, write to me about it at luxocultpod@gmail.com, or you can get me on Instagram at luxocultpod. I would like to know. So in case anybody who's listening can't tell the difference, that was 100% a joke, satire, sarcasm. That's not a real thing that can happen. Please read a book, but please read something other than the Malleus Maleficarum. Perhaps like the one my guest and I will be discussing today, Consorting with Spirits. Okay, I will be back before the bibliomancy break to talk about my new album of what I am calling Ritually Produced Aural Erotica and the experiments I conducted surrounding creating haunted objects while making it. And I'll share some examples from it too as bumper music in the episode. There's also some awesome listener mail that I am stoked to share with y'all. But now I'm going to play a little bit of a track from my new album. This one is called Machina Abstracta. And on the other side of that, let's dive right into my chat with Jason Miller. Cheers.
It's a machine that hasn't been built yet. It still remains on the periphery of my perception. But I will build this machine. And I will climb it. And I will transport myself in the direction of liberation. It's the 7th of March.
All right, well, I am here with Jason Miller. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you. For those who are not familiar with your work, would you mind giving a quick intro, like who you are, what you're into, what you're up to?
Oh, man, it just changes constantly. all right, so first and foremost, I write occult books and teach classes in practical magic. I've got a wide, varied background. I used to have this bio that I would send out and be like, you know, oh, I belong to this and I went here and I did that. And finally, I just like got rid of all that. And I was like, look, you know, I've been some places, I've done some things, and I've written some stuff about magic. And the most important thing is other people that I try to teach magic to tell me that I'm good at it and that they learn from what I teach. And that's really the only thing, the only parameter, right? The only degree that matters. So yeah, I write and teach on magic professionally. 'Tis my only job.
All right. Fuck yeah. Well, so we're going to be talking about your newest book today, Consorting with Spirits. And I have to say, there was a lot that I liked about it, including some of the things about the tone in which you chose to write it. I think there's definitely a very nice contemporary feel to it, which I found very fresh. There's even a sort of like meme kind of in there about like occultists, you know. Yeah, it's very funny. So it's good stuff. Can we talk a little bit about the title?
Yeah. So Consorting with Spirits, this is the only book I've ever written where the title came first. And I contacted Wiser and I was like, I have this book, but this is the title. Like, because very, like, I actually didn't title most of my other books. So, you know, Protection and Reversal Magic and The Sorcerer's Secrets, which is now going to be called Real Sorcery soon, the publisher titled the books. But this is, you know, I sort of like, nope, has to be Consorting with Spirits. Because there's really two meanings to that I wanted to get across. The first is that it's the title of a crime that you would have been charged with and I would have been charged with back in England in the, you know, 17th, 18th century or so. And we would have been charged with consorting with spirits. So it is literally the name of a crime. And while certainly many people have been accused of witchcraft and consorting with spirits and things like this that really did nothing of the sort, we know that in that time period, people were doing that. We know this because even if you disbelieve every testimony as coerced, which that's not really the case. It's pretty clear that some were and some were not. We have receipt books and recipe books and spells and you know, surviving practices. So, you know, not entire religions or something, but we know very well that people were risking being charged with a crime and potentially executed to have relations with spirits, to consort with spirits, to have spirit friends and familiars. And the other aspect of consorting is, of course, it's ongoing, right? Like, if you are going out and you're, I don't know, you're meeting some illicit person, like a gangster or, you know, somebody that you shouldn't be about with, you know, and you do it once, that's just, you know, that's a meeting. But when you're regularly meeting up with them, you're consorting, right? And so I wanted to write Consorting with Spirits because so many books and so much instruction is just sort of like, well, here, pick what you want, open up a book, pick the spirit, whether it's a saint or a demon or whatever, contact that spirit, you know, and then you walk away. Whereas for magicians and witches and sorcerers, we develop relationships over time, right? It's not just look it up in the book and dial it and make a deal. They become the people in your neighborhood, like that old song from when I was a kid back in the 70s. Here are the people in your neighborhood. So the spirits are the people in your neighborhood. They're the spirits in your neighborhood. And they're the spirits that you've invited in, that you have long-standing relationships with. And that way of working magic is very different than just, you know, calling things up. So that's the other meaning of consorting with spirits. I wanted to talk about that and make the book about that, how that plays out in reality.
All right. Fuck yeah. That makes me wonder, do you think that there might be something in the idea that, you know, to be a magic user, a magician, witch, or whatever people like to call themselves, and to do this types of activities, is there something inherently, I don't want to say like criminal about it, but something that sets us on this like liminal boundary where it's like you sort of are all of a sudden perhaps in maybe what we consider make more dicey territory in terms of how the rest of the world would see us? And is that necessary?
Well, you know, So people have made a lot about this, right? Like people have taken this idea and run with it to the idea of like, you know, well, the magic is the tool of the oppressed. And it is, you know, I don't want to say that it's not, but then they'll say, therefore it belongs to the oppressed. And that's not entirely true. You know, I mean, John Dee was not oppressed.
Yes, if we look at most of Western occultism.
In general, you know, he enjoyed the favor of Queen Elizabeth. We're not talking about, you know, somebody who was oppressed. So I think magic being magic, it does place you a little bit, you know, different than just sort of John Q. Public, right? So it's something that's a little outside of society. But this is maybe where the archetype of the witch and the wizard differ. Just and this is broad strokes analogies. So please, you know, anyone listening, don't take this as like fixed ideas. This is so loose, it's almost pointless. But, you know, you tend to think of the witch as like the person outside of town, right? They're outside of society in that they are on the liminal edge. And when they come into town, they get looked at askance. They're not part of society. They're kind of a critic of it from the outside. But the wizard is kind of outside society too, but shapes it in a way. Think about Merlin, right? He's standing right next to Arthur. You think about Dee standing, you know, he's got the ear of the queen. You think of other figures. And so they're maybe they're outside society in a way that's almost like above.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking of like the priest classes in some societies.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So they're not necessarily outside of, but they're not, you know, it's not like what they do is understood well by everyone, but it's different. So in the end, I think the witch or the magician or the wizard or whatever anybody wants to call themselves, you can position yourself however you want in society. You know, I just to give you an idea, like I live a fairly middle class life in rural Vermont. I just bought a house, so I just moved, and the people I sold it to, like they knew who I was, they could Google me, and they were like, you know, we Googled your site, and, you know, we chose you over the other buyers, partly because it's so cool what you do. And even the person at the mortgage company was like, you know, oh, I went and, you know, I have to check out your business, make sure it's legit, of course. She's like, but I was enthralled. I'm, you know, you might be hearing from. So I think sometimes people automatically feel like, you know, I am the witch, therefore I must be outside of society. Like you can, but you don't have to be, like, necessarily. Some people are, some people aren't. And so it's liminal in that, for sure, you're going to have, like, you can't walk into a meeting at work and start talking about curses and influence and, and, like, you know, spells and stuff like that.
I suppose it depends on where you work, but
it depends on where you work, for sure. But you know, in general, like, you know, if you're at the AIG boardroom, it's not going to fly. Yet people at AIG or Ernst & Young or something like that might contact someone to do that work for them. But that's a whole other issue. But yeah, these things are not as far out of society as sometimes people make them out to be. But certainly it is a tool available to people that are outside of society. It's liminal in that science doesn't acknowledge it. So in that way, it's always going to be liminal. And I get really kind of, I don't like it when people try to rectify magic and science very much. It often doesn't serve either one very well.
Yes, I think it requires a very delicate approach. And like, you can sort of use scientific tools to measure things about the results of your magic, perhaps, but I don't think that science is a tool that can necessarily be reconciled with magic. I think that they are different in form and function and for different things. Yeah. I have a scientific background, so I'm very into like using scientific principles as metaphors for things that I do in magic, but I wouldn't say that I am using science for magic, because science is a tool for determining things in a sort of objective way, or it's trying to, whereas that magic defies all that just sort of by definition. So I think it's just a misunderstanding of using the tools personally.
Perfectly. Yeah. And the principles, for sure, like the principles of experimentation and recording results and observing are all solid. I guess it's when people start to, you know, oh, well, you know, quantum mechanics does. And I'm like, yeah, unless you can calculate, like, you know, Hilbert space, you can really just shut up.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the way I feel about it is it's like, look, if that like turns you on and that like sort of gets you in the mood and gets your like gears going thinking about magic shit, then like whatever. But like, don't mistake that for like grounded understanding.
Right. Right. It's you know, and for sure, science has always given, well, I mean, everything has always given magic analogies to work with, you know. I mean, at the time of the electric revolution and radio waves and all this, that's when we started to talk about energy and talk about magnetism and things like that in magic and spirituality and so on. So, but it doesn't mean we can measure, like, you know, amps and ohms and voltage of, you know, of a spell.
I mean, yeah. And also in terms of experimental design, like, there's so many unforeseen parameters. It would be, I don't know, it's a fool's errand, honestly. So yes. Okay, so we're going to be talking about consorting with spirits. Let's talk about consent first and, you know, respect and authority and the sort of like relationship that these things have together. Because I think you do a good job in your book sort of sorting out this, you know, sort of nuanced issue.
Yeah. So I've got a rule that simplifies it all, like simplifies just everything dealing with spirits. How would it work if you were dealing with people? And I think I wrote a blog post recently. It was, you know, my complete essay on magical ethics. It was some title that was like ridiculously long. And then you click on the post and it just said, use the same ethics you use for everything else. like it's not any different. It's magic doesn't require special ethics. And spirits, so many of the issues, if you just think about how it is with people. So, you know, consent, right? With most people, most of the time, you want to meet them on a footing of mutual benefit and whatnot. And that's how things are most of the time. And then there are issues where there's conflict, right? Where somebody is, you know, something is intrusive and therefore there's no consent. It's just a matter of winning, you know? And then there are issues where there's, you know, contracts, say between employer and employee. And it's like, well, you know, you agreed to do this and I'm counting on you to do this. So now I have to compel you to do this. And so these are just different shades of how things work with people. And it works the same with spirits. I think it's important that someone be able to exercise, which means to compel by oath, or, you know, to make a spirit do something or to get rid of a spirit that's bothering you. I think if you can't do those things, then, or have some kind of authority that you can exercise, then maybe messing with spirits is not the best idea. But the idea that you would need to exercise that all the time for no reason is just false, right? Like, if you're a police officer, I hope that you don't like walk into Starbucks, grab the barista, slam them on the table, and like, you know, draw your gun, make me a coffee now. Like, no, you go in and you order your coffee and you pay for it. And, or if it's somebody that you just want to talk to, you talk to them, and one does not exercise the full weight of authority in every single exchange, even in most exchanges. So it all goes back to that, Roosevelt, you know, walk softly, carry a big stick.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, it you know, so I like to work with spirits that like to work with me. I don't really dig working with spirits that I have to compel or that are super hard to reach. But at times you need to do what you got to do, and it's just like it is with people.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to have maybe like a big public party, you want to have some, you know, if you're inviting a bunch of people into a space, like you want to be able to have some measure to remove people that might not be behaving themselves or whatever.
Absolutely. And one of the nice things about having a large party is that there will be people there who, you know, will stand by your side as mm-hmm. well. So one of the things I love about general offerings is, you know, maybe you have spirits around that are very picky, like, you know, say vegetarian spirits, right? And they don't even want musk in their incense. But if it's a general offering to all the spirits, well, then they're just showing up, right? And so they can't get too pissy about what's offered and what's not, because it's not just for them. It's kind of like if you're vegetarian and you show up to a party, there should be a vegetarian dish, but you're not going to get out of joint if there are non-vegetarian dishes, because it's a big party. But if I invite a vegetarian over for dinner and then I serve them steak, they have every right to be offended, because that was a one-on-one scenario where I was sort of like, hey, come on over, we'll sit down. And then I serve you something that, you know, you find repugnant. That's horrible. Same with spirits, right? If we sit down to do a Naga puja and then we offer a bunch of meat, the Nagas are going to get upset. But if we call the Nagas, as well as a whole bunch of other classifications of spirits, then they're not going to get upset because it's a general offering.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So one of the stories that I loved hearing in this book was about your interaction with Peggy Clevenger and the sort of salt she threw your way. I love this example because you make the point of saying, like, well, if the spirits are only telling you stuff you want to hear and how great you are and how powerful of a magician you are, whatever you're hearing, like, definitely want to be cognizant of what that might mean.
Yeah, for sure. So Peggy Clevenger is a woman who lived in the New Jersey Pine Barrens and was rumored to be a witch. The story is that she and her husband both practiced witchcraft and magic. And the story goes that he died first and told her that if hell was real, he would make the water in the well boil. And supposedly, the water in the well at their house near Mount Misery. I swear to God, it's a real place. Mount Misery.
This is all very metal.
Yeah, you know, it does. It sounds, you know, go to Mount Misery. It's like
the water in the well will boil at Mount Misery.
But yeah, no, it's a real place. Actually, there's a Methodist retreat center on Mount Misery. So
that's very funny.
And it's not a mountain. I don't know where it got called Mount anything. There's no mountains in the New Jersey Pine Barrens. But anyway, I digress. So the story is that it did bubble and boil. But Peggy was the one most known as a witch in the Pine Barrens, even more than her husband. And the story is eventually she was murdered in her home. She supposedly used to pay for things out of a sock. And then the money would disappear from the registers and whatnot. When she was gone, there would just be shells and things left. So she used to pay with this illusory money. But at any rate, you know, whether she's was really a witch or not, I was sort of interested in making contact. But of course, no one knows where she's buried, so we don't have that link. And there's no signatures or anything left, which is another way that you can connect with someone, like finding a signature on their mortgage documents or something like that, like people have done with Dr. John in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. So I just, you know, I set about trying to find the house and the well, and then I would go to some blue holes, which are these spots in the Pine Barrens with cold water that remains cold year round. And it's a weird sort of blue when all the other water in the Pine Barrens is sort of orange because it's stained with iron. So there's three of these blue holes, and I went to them just sort of calling for Peggy Clevenger and trying to summon her forth. And finally, you know, through the agency, through some work with Hecate, and she comes through and was basically like, you are just a bumbling idiot. And like, you would have been killed already if it wasn't for, you know, your connection to Hecate. Like, what do you want? And so it was through Hecate and Lampads, night nymphs, that the connection was eventually made. And then it was a fruitful connection. So there was a lot of instruction that came forward about the relationship between black, white, and red oak that were found, you know, that you can find in the pines, and what the pygmy pines that only grow there would be useful for in magic and things like that. So, yeah.
Very cool.
You know, it's a little persistent, but, you know, you're living there and you've got this legendary figure who lived there. So why not?
Yeah, very cool. Fuck around and find out, as they say. Absolutely.
Fuck around and find out.
Well, Jason, how would you feel about taking a bibliomancy break?
A bibliomancy break. A
bibliomancy break. Hey, what's up? It's me, Luxa from the future. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. It was very cool talking with Jason Miller. We're going to be getting into more of our conversation about consorting with spirits and all kinds of other stuff, as well as diving in for that bibliomancy break in just a bit here. But now, in lieu of the usual episode within the episode, I bring you special guest Luxa, here to talk about the new Sound Magic album, Kaleidikos. Hello, so happy to be here, Luxa. Just kidding. Sorry, I'm not going to make you all listen to me interview myself. That seems like it would be pretty demented, even for this show. It might be funny, though. Honestly, I think I'm just a little bit nervous to be talking about my experiments with consorting with spirits in making this new album, Kaleidikos, which is a sort of audio offering to Hecate. There have been several of you who have written in suggesting that you would like to hear more about what I'm up to magically, and I hear you, and hopefully this short discussion of my album will satisfy. When I started developing my process in doing the work associated with my first music project, which was called Gratis Animus, I definitely would not have imagined being where I find myself now, which is talking about it in this fairly public manner here on my show. So the very idea of like making and then sharing something like so personal as this stuff was at first for me like just incredibly wild and paradigm shifting in a way. And doing it represented a pretty big step towards trying to find the means of authentic communication or authentic expression or whatever. So I wrote an essay about my first project in which I talk about some of what went into it and describe some ideas I have about using sexual magic for the purposes of like dissolving shame and trauma and doing healing and transformation stuff. And you can find a link to that stuff in the show notes in my link tree. So for some context, the process that I use to create what I'm calling, as I said, ritually produced aural erotica, aural having to do with sound, of course, involves me listening to a track while recording more layers to add to it. Through this positive feedback loop situation, a lot of complexity can arise. More and more, as I worked with creating tracks using the process I was developing, I began to sense the spirit or whatever of the work, or maybe of the process itself. That's not really quite clear to me. Regardless, I got the sense that it really wanted to be expressed in these kind of like fun, bombastic ways, like these interesting ways, and I really wanted to have the chance to interact with it more directly, to have a sort of like ecstatic congress with the music itself on like a more physical level, if that makes sense. During one of my recording sessions, I was struck with the edges of an idea about how I might be able to do this. And later on, as I was doing some sound editing, the idea sort of coalesced for me. I was looking at the waveform signature in the sound editing software that I use, which is called Audacity, and I somehow accidentally zoomed way in on it. And what I saw when I did was that the waveform looked a lot like a spiral to me. It sort of reminded me of an image of an RNA strand, which is like a DNA strand only with a single helix instead of a double one. Anyway, I was struck with the notion that music might be able to carry the same kind of informational signature as the codons and genetics do, a sort of formula that gives rise to life, or the potential for it, if you will. Please don't take what I'm saying too literally here. I'm using biological analogies because that's a big part of my frame of reference for things, but don't like mistake what I'm saying for science or whatever. This is just to try to help explain a more abstract concept. Anyway, as I considered the notion of intentionally creating a music track that had the informational signature or whatever necessary to enliven something, I began to look for items which I felt might be good candidates to try this out with. So the first thing I decided to try this experiment out with was an app-controlled sex toy that has a feature which allows the user to play music through it. I did some stuff to ritually prepare the item, you know, consecrate it and get it sort of all energetically in line with what was already happening in the project and whatnot. I also used it a few times before I performed this stuff just to sort of establish a baseline. After I performed the ritual I used to initialize the process, I began to experiment with playing the specially made track through the device. And what I found was very interesting. There was an immediate sense of interacting with something more alive and present than there had been before. And there had always been a sense of collaboration when, like, working with the spirit of the project or whatever, but this experiment brought that experience into, like, much sharper focus, and it definitely made it feel like it was happening on maybe a bigger order of magnitude. I decided to repeat this process again using a different item. This one was a music-based children's toy called Rizmo. It's what I now refer to lovingly as a Ratchet Furby. So shout out to Joy for that contextualization of it. One of the last things I recorded for the album was me and my haunted Rizmo hanging out and listening to the haunting track together. And you can hear Rizmo's reactions to it in there, which is pretty fun and creepy. So I decided to put a sort of seal on all of the tracks that I'm going to be releasing for this. Even though it was just the one that I made, which was specifically designed to haunt items, it just seemed like a prudent thing to do for reasons which are most likely obvious. But if there's anybody out there who would like to try to make their own haunted sex toy or haunted Rizmo or whatever weird shit you're into, let me know and I can give you a version of the track without the protective measures I put into it. I obviously don't think this is, like, bad or dangerous or whatever, like, to experiment with since I messed around with it a bunch. It's just about intentionality is all. So you can find a link to the sealed versions of all the tracks and a super cut I made of the album, as well as an essay I wrote about making it in the show notes as soon as it is released, which should be a little bit after this episode comes out. I've also decided to include in the album a version of the last track that got all glitched out after I called the entity or spirit or whatever that I've been working with a rude name. Don't be a dick, Alexa, for real. So I apologized, but the damage was, like, already done, and I couldn't even save the track or export it from Audacity, and I had to get really creative to rescue the glitchy version of it. Honestly, it sounds cooler than the one that I mixed, which is pretty fun, so fuck yeah. My unseen helpers and I have been working super hard on this project for over a year now, and I feel like all of us are pretty stoked to be finally putting it out there. It's super weird and intense and personal. I'm also very nervous and a bit uncomfortable about it, and I think that because of this, it's going to feel incredibly liberating. So if you're into esoteric audio erotica or sex magic or a fan of electronic music or poetry or flagrant displays of female pleasure, check out the album Kleidikos. Okay, so I will be back after the interview to give you all an update about what's going on with the Green Mushroom Project, as well as to share some of that sweet, sweet listener mail. There's some good stuff in there. But now I'm going to play you a little bit of the haunting track, the sealed version of it, called Vested, and on the other side of that, we are going to be rolling into that bibliomancy break and more of my chat with Jason Miller. Cheers.
So how does this work?
So this is a break time activity that I do with guests. I have a set of, like, roll tables. So I'll go ahead and have you ask the question. You can ask the oracle whatever you like, and then I will roll the dice and see what text we will be consulting, and then I'll go ahead and give you a reading.
Oh, man. What to ask, though? I don't even... There's so little I want to know.
Fair enough.
There's so little that I want to know. So many things that are, you know, I just look at it, I'm like, well, that's just going to go bad. I don't want to depress myself thinking about that.
Yes, it depends on where you look, of course, but yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, let's forecast the let's take a look at the British pound. That almost collapsed okay. last night. So let's take a look at and see, how's the pound going to do in the next year?
All right, let's see here. How will the British pound fare within the next year? All right, so it's going to be item 3 from table 7. The house at Pooh Corner. All right, let me go grab it. I will be right back here.
The house at Pooh Corner.
That's right. All right, I have located this text here. Ellers, tell us about how the British pound is going to do. Well, said Christopher Robin, we shall have to go find them. That's all. Come on, Tigger. And I shall have to go find them too, explained Tigger and Roo. May I find them too? Asked Roo eagerly. I think not today, dear, said Kanga. Another day. Well, if they're lost tomorrow, may I find them? We'll see, said Kanga and Roo, who had knew that meant went into a corner and practiced jumping out at himself, particularly because he wanted to practice this, and particularly because he didn't want Christopher Robin and Tigger to think that he had minded when they went off without him.
Okay.
Well, often is helpful for me to sort of like marinate on these and parse them out a little. But yes, we're seeing some kind of an interesting thing about a separation. It reminds me of Britain seceding from the EU. And here we have this, you know, Tigger jumping up and down by himself while the other folks have gone away. So I don't know. That's just what comes to mind to me. But thank you, Eris. Appreciate it.
No, it is. That's a good insight. That's solid. The only thing I remember from the house at Pooh Corner was, oh God, what was it? It was something like poetry and hums aren't things that you get. They're things that get you, and all you can do is go with them.
That tracks very hard.
Yeah.
So at this point in the show, I like to ask my guests if they have any kind of thoughts about divination.
I divine far less than most people do. I think that divination is a good tool, but it was kind of funny because the better I got at it, the less helpful it was to people.
Like a sort of Cassandra thing or like?
Well, yeah. So, you know, people would come and let's say you had an idea, right? Something you wanted to do. They would come and sort of be like, well, you know, will anything go wrong? Well, yeah, something will. No matter what it is you're doing, something is if it's of sufficient complexity to receive a reading about, something's probably going to go wrong.
Yeah, no plan survives first contact. Everybody knows that. Yes.
On some stage, something is going to go wrong. But it would just freak people out. They'd be like, oh, well then, you know, I better not. Or I'm going to tread carefully. So I saw people with solid ideas kind of become scared of their own ideas for fear that something goes wrong. And I didn't see too much of the opposite. I didn't see too much of people going, well, I wasn't going to do this, but now I definitely am because it's awesome. Right. Yeah. So I don't, you know, I started to evaluate things more on, is this a good idea or is this not a good idea? And when I did use divination, I made sure to treat it as a data point, right? So intelligence agencies separate the idea of data and intel. Intel is actionable intel. Right? Like it's enough to make a choice upon. Divination, I treat as data. It is one data point from which you can then weave actionable intelligence along with other points of data. But sometimes if people are scared of something, or if it's something that's not easily verifiable, or if it plays to one's fears, divination can be like the end, the start and the end. And there are certainly some folks who are like, nope, my divinations are right. They are always right. And, you know, I just had a talk with somebody about this, and they said, you know, I've devoted my life to divining, and I don't like when you said divination is just one data point and, you know, it might be wrong. Entire traditions are built on divination. I said, yes, divination is real. And just like other real things, it can be wrong. If it's never wrong, then it's really not within the realm of real things. Like doctors can be wrong, lawyers can be wrong. So if they can be wrong, and Lord knows economists can be wrong. So if those fields can be wrong, but you're telling me divination can never be wrong, then, you know, now I'm just getting even more skeptical. So I think it's a good tool. It's a good piece of data to have to throw up against other pieces of data, human intelligence, signal intelligence, just observing reality around you. But yeah, that's how I treat divination. And I have another rule for divination, which is that it's better to be wrong than vague. So I can give you an example if you want.
Sure.
So in August 2016, I did a divination on Facebook. So, you know, hundreds of people saw it and weighed in, where I predicted that Donald Trump would win the presidential election. Something that I, by the way, did not want to happen. I don't tend to talk politics, but I'll go ahead and say that was, you know, worst case scenario for me. But people were like, you know, oh no, it's wrong. You know this, and I was like, nope, this is what the divination says. Mm-hmm. And then I was speaking at a conference called the Crucible in October 2016, and somebody brought that up. And of course, October 2016, polls were like, you know, Hillary Clinton has a 97% chance of winning, right? Nobody thought that it would turn out the way it did. And so people were like, you know, now we see how this is going to go. Like, it's a lock. Do you want to reinterpret? And I said, no, I'd rather be wrong than be vague. I'd rather just stand up and say, this was my finding. And if it's wrong, be wrong. Because again, everybody can be wrong. Lawyers can be wrong. Doctors, economists, weathermen, et cetera, they can be wrong. But if they're vague, then it's not useful to anyone. Then it's a matter of positioning myself to be right no matter what. It stops being about providing something helpful to people and starts and becomes about, ah, well, you see, I did in fact predict that.
Yes. And not to mention the potential, I suspect, damage that like readjusting your positions versus like your actual, you know, instinct about what it means as a diviner and then going back and revising that based on events. Like that seems like it might erode your, I don't know, sensitivity to it. Just a thought.
It does. So, you know, I just stuck with it and I was like, but I, you know, and I, you know, in my head, I agreed with everyone else. I'm like, obviously the divination was wrong. In the end, the cards were smarter than I was, but you know, it is that kind of like, I'd rather arrive at something, be wrong, learn from it, than be vague and kind of like not have anything useful.
Sure. Well, I think this is a great sort of segue into what I was hoping to ask you about next, which is this sort of dichotomy, not really dichotomy, but the relationship between perception and projection that you discuss, and sort of this idea of there are, you know, different ways of interpreting the data that comes in. In addition to that, there's definite like perceptive differences between individuals. Like the topic of aphantasia has been coming up a lot lately as we're becoming more aware that some people see a lot of pictures in their minds and some people don't really see any, and that's just how it is. And you mentioned that, like, whether or not you're sensitive to spirit interaction or seeing spirits, or whether this is something that you might need to, like, work on to gain skill in, there's going to be challenges for both types of people. And so you shouldn't be, like, jealous of your friends or whatever.
Oh yeah. This is one of those things that I have to keep repeating over and over and over and over and over again in every class I teach, because of course, you know, you teach an online class and then there's an online forum, but it was no different when it was offline. You know, you go to a class and I don't know, somebody would make an invocation and then everyone would close their eyes. And then somebody always, like, pops out, they're jumping out of their seat. They can't wait to say what amazing things this phantasmagoric experience had, right? Like at the open circle, and it's like, you know, oh yes, you know, you prayed to Hecate and then I closed my eyes and then she came down and she put a crown on my head and we flew off into a wonderland of, and it's just sort of like, okay. And then other people are like, you know, Charlie Brown, like, I got a rock. Like, I didn't get anything.
I felt the chill, or like, yeah, I mean, that's something though. Yeah.
But it's like, no. And like, let's take these two extremes and realize what's going on. Like, one person is getting a spark of the spirit and they're taking it and running with it. Let's go back and take a look at all of what they said. What in there is actionable or meaningful? Right? And then 98% of the time, there's nothing. Right? I mean, meaning in the sense of like, well, cool, something happened. That's cool. Right? So you can take that as like a thumbs up or a pat on the back or whatever. But when people have these constant, like, just every time they close their eyes, some spirit that coincidentally they just read about is calling them you know, and then you look at what they get shown and it's like, okay, you know, it doesn't really amount to much in the way of what's actionable or useful. And then you've got people that are supposedly head blind. They can't see, but very often what's happening is that they do get a little spark of something and they're judging it right off the bat, right? Like, well, is it that or is it not that? You know, that's probably not really Hecate. That's just me. That's just my mind. So it's kind of like that moment, like when you're teaching someone to ride a bike and you let go, and then they're riding a bike just fine, and then they realize you've let go, and then they fall. You know, it's like, nope, you were doing fine. Just keep rolling with it, and you'd probably get something. You might be an amazing sender. You might be someone whose spells manifest consistently over time, which is way more useful than, you know, having Orishas show up and do dances and, you know, whatever it is. So this idea of perception projection ratio, right? People always want to know, was this my mind or was this the spirit? And I'm always like, that's not a helpful way to look at it, because everything that you've ever experienced, you've only experienced it through your own mind. So there is a big blend of your own projections and accurate perception into every experience you've ever had. So if that's true of like the hard experiences of going to get a coffee or, you know, whatever it is, how much more true is it of subtle experiences, of experiences that we aren't ordinarily oriented to, of beings that are by definition more subtle than we are? We should expect that ratio to be worse. But we still set up this dichotomy as if, well, it was either 100% real, the spirit spoke and it said what it said, or 100% fantasy. And that's not a helpful view. We should be looking at it as a ratio or as a spectrum between those two extremes. And we should get skeptical every time it starts to get close. We start to think of it more and more as 100%. But I'll tell you, and that's how I wrote about it in the book. But I'll tell you what, I'm even more ruthless than that with my own stuff. I don't even care about the perception projection ratio anymore. It really just comes down to, was there anything meaningful or actionable? If it's not meaningful or actionable, it doesn't really matter whether it was a spirit, your own mind, or some mix thereof, because there's nothing to do or apply, right? It's just a thing that happened. Doesn't mean that it's a false thing, doesn't mean that there wasn't spirit involved, but you don't have to lay a judgment on it. You can just say, okay, that happened. Let's move on, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas if there is something that is meaningful or actionable, then we have to look at and say, well, does the action make sense? And is the meaning applicable, right? Is the meaning helpful? If the action makes sense or the meaning is applicable, then again, what difference does it make where on that spectrum the experience lied? Let's just say it was entirely mind-generated. Well, okay, you did this ritual to Hecate, and then you had this experience that gave you something useful and meaningful. What difference does it make, the percentage of which it came from Hecate versus you?
Yeah, they're operationally the same, right?
Right. Yeah. So when it, you know, the first thing I tell people is like, let go of this either or binary and get more into this idea of a spectrum. And then in the end, just start looking at what you're actually doing. And even then, all of that stuff falls away. Unless you're trying to create a theology of facts, which magic and religion and philosophy are bad at. Like, they're just bad at it. then it doesn't matter. So, yeah.
Yeah, I like that phrase, a theology of facts. Unfortunately, I think that that's the role that science is starting or has taken in our culture, where it was never meant to be like that. And it's actually a threat to itself now. But I don't want to digress too far.
Yeah, it can be. It can be.
Greetings, it is I, Alexa from the future, again. I hope you are enjoying the episode so far. As promised, I am here to share a quick poetry snack with you all. This is by Sandra Cisneros from her book Loose Woman, entitled Little Clown, My Heart. Little clown, my heart, spangled again and lopsided, handstands and Peking pirouettes, backflip snapping open like a carpenter's hinged ruler. Little gimp-footed hooray, paper parasol of pleasure, fleshy undertongue of sorrows, sweet potato plant of my addictions. Acapulco cliff diver, Corazon, fine as an obsidian dagger, alley-oop, and here we go, into the froth, my life, into the flames. All right, cheers. Let's dive back in for the rest of my chat with Jason Miller. I like that you mentioned that one of the biggest dangers, and this reminds me of your first comments about divination, about people being afraid to act because something may go wrong, you know, in this vague way. And one of the biggest dangers you noted about magic is it has the potential for you to reinforce the status quo rather than moving away from it, you know, out of the cage, as you put it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's probably the, like, one of the biggest dangers for sure. It's especially dangerous, I think, when people are leading lives they don't particularly like. Like, I don't think there's any problem using magic to reinforce a status quo. You're digging.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, but it's a matter of uncertainty, right? It's a matter of uncertainty. You're in a job that you don't like, and then you're in danger of losing that job. And it's like, wow, okay, I'd better do magic to protect this job, because I don't know where the next job is coming from. I'd better do magic to protect this relationship that I constantly complain about because I don't know if anyone else will ever decide to date me again, right? Mm-hmm. These kinds of things are, they're just the death of growth. And with magic, we can often trap ourselves big time.
I think, yeah, definitely something, you know, as thinking about the perception, you know, whatever ratio, I think that's definitely something to look into too, is, you know, is this reinforcing the status quo, what I'm getting, or is, in what ways is this challenging me versus maybe coddling me, or like, yeah, lots of things there.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious about your creative process, especially as it concerns this book. Do you have spirit allies? Do you consort with spirits as part of your creative work? And was that the case here?
I do. There's almost always a spirit or a few behind every book. So in particular, the demon Astaroth had a lot to say about this book, and Hecate, who always is a being that I work with extensively since the year 2000, has weighed in heavily on this book. And I suppose to a lesser extent, Saint Cyprian as well. So these three kind of represent three of the angles that the book tries to approach from, right? So from a sort of mystical Christian angle, from a diabolistic or Luciferian angle, and a pagan angle. I wanted to show how a few of the operations would look coming from each of those backgrounds, because it's not simply a matter of just ripping out the stuff you don't want and throwing in the names you do want. It changes the whole operation.
Yeah, an operation needs to have like a structural cogency to it. I mean, you can shift things around in a building, but if you shift too many things down, the roof's going to fall or whatever.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, if you take a figure like, a demon, and you're approaching the evocation from a Christian angle, as most of the grimoires do, well, now you're ordering that demon based upon the power of the opposing conquering forces, right? Like in the name of the Lord and, you know, Yahweh and everything else. If, however, you're approaching it from a Luciferian angle, then you're approaching it from its own side, so to speak, right? Like, so I'm conjuring you in the name of Lucifer and Astaroth and Beelzebub and you know, your immediate superiors, as opposed to these people who are going to kick the shit out of you. And then if you're approaching it from a pagan angle, then you're not approaching it from either of those. You're kind of approaching it as, you know, okay, well, you know, you're this spirit who, whether you were pagan or not pagan, your seal at least comes from this Christo-diabolic paradigm, but I'm calling you under the name of Hecate. And how does that work, right? Do the seals even still have the same meaning, since they all go back to exorcisms and conjurations that were done under certain parameters? So what meaning does that have in this context now? We know it has some meaning because, of course, just like people, authority is authority, and there are different types and different ways of applying power.
Yes.
But yeah, the type of and way that you do it is very different, right? Depending upon how it comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. The kind of metaphor I'm thinking here with like the different approaches using the, you know, kind of traditional methods from maybe the Ars Goetia versus the more like Luciferian ones that you laid out in the book is sort of like the spirit might feel obligated either way, but it might be like the difference between being like subpoenaed to court and like being invited to a work party where you have to show up or whatever.
There you go. That's an excellent analogy. I love that. I'm totally going to steal that.
It's yours. All right, the last thing, and maybe the most, perhaps, I don't know, I like that we're going to finish this because you do call it rule number one. And this is actually something that I find very important too. This is how, you know, we start the Green Mushroom Project statement of resistance with resist by maintaining sovereignty of the self. And you talk about how, you know, as a magician, we must always maintain self-sovereignty.
Yes. So, you know, to the extent possible.
Sure.
You know, you can, for instance, you know, if you get pulled over, explain to the police officer that you are a sovereign citizen. You're just going to get hauled into jail. So
your laws don't apply to me, officer.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it happens. People try, but it doesn't work because somebody has the power, you know, the state has the monopoly on the power of violence. So it becomes then a matter of, you know, who has power over you. But same thing with your work, right? Like they have the power to compel you. But a lot of times people start giving over their sovereignty to beings that have no power to compel them. They give it freely just so that they don't have it anymore. It's like, well, I summoned a spirit and the spirit, like, I asked it for a job and it gave me this completely horrible job. But I guess that's where I'm supposed to be because the spirit sent me there. Like, no, you asked a spirit to do something. It did it, but it didn't do it in a way that you wanted or that is fruitful to you. I mean, I once did magic to get a job and was offered a job as a security guard at a hospital for the criminally insane. I was like, thanks, but no thanks. I'm good. I'm like, you know, I don't even know why I'm I know it was magic because I'm not even qualified for that job. I don't even know how I got on the list, but there you go.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, I'm not doing that. But that's the thing. A lot of people don't exercise that sovereignty. They give it away right away. Well, what is meant for me? What am I meant to do? What do the gods want me to do? And you see this all the time. People, I mean, it's kind of run amok. Maybe it's just online, but I see people online and no one ever says, I'm interested in this, so therefore I took it up. It's always, I've been called to this. I'm feeling myself called to this. I'm feeling that I'm meant to do this or that the spirits want me to do this. Almost like they're just helplessly a bob on this, you know, getting pushed by this way and that, by the universe or spirits or things like this. It's like,
or perhaps by their own impulses.
Yes. Well, that's the thing. Like, it's their own impulses. But if you can kind of shift it so that you're meant to do it, then you don't have to take responsibility if something goes wrong. Right? It's you know, when people are cursed or think that they're cursed, I mean, curses happen. Don't get me wrong. I wrote my first book because people were not taking the idea of magical protection seriously 16 years ago. Whereas now I feel like they're taking it like, yes, magical attacks happen all the time and for no good reason. You're probably cursed now. Right? Like, it's like, whoa, hey, you know, settle down, folks. You know, yes, it's real. I'm glad you came around to that, but that doesn't mean it happens all the time for no reason whatsoever. But it's a very attractive proposition because it means that you are important, right? Because the gods wouldn't have these plans for you or if in the case of an attack, they wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't be suffering under somebody wanting to mess with you unless you were important. So it bolsters the ego, but it also removes responsibility. Well, it's not me who chose this to, you know, open up a business selling, I don't know, poetry books or something, right? Not that I have anything at all against poetry or stores that sell poetry books. And if they're positioned well, I'm sure they'd do well. But, you know, if not, then it's you know, it was just came to mind as like a thing that would not be viable in most places. And so if they get into that headspace and they're like, well, I was pushed to do it by the spirits. I was led there, right? And I've even, you know, you even see people do things like they'll post things that I wrote or that other authors have written, and they'll post it somewhere for free and like without our name attached. Like sometimes it's just plagiarized right from our books or courses or something. And people will say, well, Hecate told me to, what would you have me do? Ignore her? And so there's like that kind of extreme, you know, well, the gods wanted me to. But, and it usually it's not something harmful like that. It's something fairly innocuous. But no one is ever just like, yeah, I'm interested in this, so I'm taking it up. It's always like, I am being led here. I am being called. I am being this, and I am being that. And the spirits want me to do this, and the spirits want me to do that. And, you know, it's like people get into magic and just feel like they have less control over their lives, when the whole idea is that it's a tool for you to have more control over your life. They're kind of turning their sovereignty over to gods, to spirits, whatever. And I'm just sort of like, nope, it's you. It's your life. You're in charge. I don't know if I wrote about it in the book, but there was a time when me and another author, we both did spells with the same angel at around the same time to bolster our side business at the time, which is, you know, teaching and whatnot. Now it's my only business, but at the time I had a day job. And we both lost our day jobs. And neither one of us were ready for ourselves to lose our day jobs yet. So my attitude was, oh no, like, you know, Sadkiel did what I asked him to do, but it's my fault because I wasn't thinking. So Sadkiel kind of looked at my life and was like, oh, you want your writing career to be more successful. Why are you spending so much time at this day job? Let's just get rid of that. You know, you have plenty of time to write. Whereas the other author was like, no, this is, you know, Sadkiel must know what's best for me. So that's what needs to happen and so on and so forth. So the entire interpretation is different. Whereas I was just kind of like, oh, I messed up that one. It was sort of like, no, I have to, you know, I immediately was like, well, better find another day job until I don't need one anymore. Whereas it was like, you know, he was like, well, I must not be meant to have one, which turned out not to be the case. So yeah, it's sovereignty, super important. Like if your magic isn't making you better able to decide what you want to do and go about executing it, then what good is it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of that equation of sovereignty that you sort of mentioned is taking accountability. Power and accountability are like intrinsically linked. And if you can't take accountability for your own life, you're giving your power away. And maybe you're feeling fancy and special because you think the gods are telling you what to do. I think that there's a real danger there losing a lot of personal power.
Oh, for sure.
No, so from my own personal perspective, like I've played with, like in my own paradigm, with the idea of like, you know, listening to Hecate and like, you know, following her instructions in this very like, you know, receptive way. But at the same time, like I still maintain this like background context of knowing that this is a sort of like exercise I'm doing, a game that we're playing together, and not some kind of ontological, I don't know, like, yeah.
Well, see, there too, it becomes, how does it work with people? Are there people that you respect that you would seek guidance from? Of course. But ultimately, you're in charge of either following that advice or not following that advice, or applying that wisdom or not applying that wisdom. So it's not about I know best and the gods should never point something out to me. But ultimately, it's just a recognition that, you know, you seek wisdom in the places that you think are people are wise, but in the end, you're responsible for the advice you implement and the wisdom that you take on.
Absolutely. Well, Jason, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you would like to discuss, or do you have any questions that you'd like to ask me?
No. See, I never know what to say at these open-ended questions, but no, I'm good.
All right. Awesome. Well, yeah, I appreciate the time and everything and all the insights. So where can people find your work?
Go to strategicsorcery.net and you will find, you know, my all my courses, blog posts, books, etc., etc. Or, you know, wherever books are sold, just look for Jason Miller and then look for the books on magic, because there's a bunch of other Jason Millers. There's like the AMA fighting Jason Miller. There's the Jason Miller who played Father Karras in The Exorcist, the playwright also. And I think there's a Jason Miller that was an advisor to the Trump administration. And
you could build yourself a whole personal pantheon out of Jason Millers.
You definitely can. There are actually two occultist Jason Millers. At one point, there were two occultist Jason Millers in the city of Philadelphia.
Fascinating.
But yep. So strategicsorcery.net, that's me. That's where to find me.
All right. Well, fuck yeah, dude. Thank you so much for taking the time. And everybody check out Consorting with Spirits.
All right. Thank you for having me on.
All right, fuck yeah. Thank you so much to Jason Miller. As I said, definitely check out Consorting with Spirits and check out strategicsorcery.net to find all of his stuff. And there will, of course, be a link to that in the show notes. Don't forget to check out all the great stuff happening on the Green Mushroom Podcast Network. We've got Administrism, Ad Hoc History, Grognostics, Primordia, XV Planis, Smuts Up, and Unearthing Paranormalcy. I'm going to go ahead and give you an update about what's going on with the Green Mushroom Project in just a little bit here, but first, let's get into some listener mail. So this first one comes from Leon, who wishes the Green Mushroom happy birthday. Thank you, Leon. And Leon also says some nice stuff here. And Leon writes in saying, I have a question. I was hoping you might be able to point me in the right direction. Dreams are a big part of my practice, and I was captivated when you talked about your control of dreams in lucid dreaming. And could you point me to a place to look for that? I'm paraphrasing here. So the other thing that Leon talks about in this missive is that in the dreams that they have sometimes, there is this conversation, and there's this kind of feeling of like getting one's hands on the divine truth or whatever it is, only to like have it slip away when you wake up, which is so often the case with these things, right? But one of the things that they mentioned in this email is that there's this idea of watching an ocean sunset, and there's this voice that says, people are like the ocean. And Leon says, the more I ponder it, the more I could expand on it, but I'm no poet. It makes me think of the changes in the ocean, like the emotions changing in the sea, or the way some people can pull you in and you find yourself drowning as you fight for breath, or the sunken wrecks and reefs that lie beneath the surface that dance like a thousand sequins in the sun. I don't know, Leon, you say you're not a poet, but this is very poetic language. I love it. The riptides and depths, sunken lost treasures ready to be found, the flashes of gold and silver of life in the blue cold deep. So I love this. Thank you so much for sharing it. The other thing that Leon mentions here is that there's this idea about using a playlist as a means of divination. And so Leon mentions, I have everything from Texas jug bands to ABBA to death metal. But sometimes while I'm away from home and have no other methods at hand for divination, I use this playlist and I put it on shuffle while holding the intent of a question. And I get the song that delivers an answer. And it's very relevant sometimes. I'm paraphrasing here. So this is very cool. I know that this is something that has come up on the Green Machine server too, this idea of using playlists as a divinatory tool, kind of like he would with a book doing bibliomancy. So I wrote back to Leon recommending the book Dreamwork by Stephen Kaplan Williams, which was something that Matt Marble had recommended. You can listen to my conversation with him in episode 28, Musical Geometry and Animus Karaoke. It's very fun stuff. So in addition to this book, which I've checked out and I think it's very cool, but to be honest, my practice has sort of just evolved over the years of mostly just journaling and kind of setting an intention before I go to sleep that I will dream lucidly. The first time I was introduced to the concept was when I was a kid and I used to have nightmares, and my mom told me that, you know, it was possible to, if one wished, kind of take control of one's dreams, and so I started to experiment with that. So anyway, most of it is just practice and perseverance, and keeping a journal of one's dreams when you wake up is super helpful too. I definitely have a lot of thoughts about the ocean thing. It's kind of funny. I don't want to give too much away because it is still an active thing going on, but it reminds me very much of an experiment that we are running on the server. So that's very fun. I love it. So Leon writes back to me, letting me know that they've been enjoying a work of fiction about witchcraft and the mob, but in the story, they use graffiti sigils on places of power or ley lines and stuff like that to kind of conduct energy from different places. And I love this idea, and it reminds me a lot of the work that the DKMU has done with the Ellis sigil or the linking sigil. And so if people are curious about the magical applications of graffiti or applying sigils in different places and sort of the idea of like setting up a network, this is definitely something that the DKMU has explored pretty extensively, and there's some interesting stuff out there about that work. So very cool stuff. Thank you so much, Leon, for writing in. I really appreciate it, and thank you so much for the kind words and for listening. Okay, so this next one is from Adam Matlock. And you can also hear a conversation that I had with Adam, aka An Historic, very talented musician and also the organizer of the Winnet Food Forest. And you can hear our talk in episode 37, Process versus Product and Hyper-Sigil Cassette Tapes. So Adam writes in reference to the last episode of this show, number 51, Fears and Phobias, with Britt from Primordia and Romancing the Unknown with Flood from XV Planets, fine members of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network, by the way. Anyway, Adam says that as much as I loathe the guy, I'm glad that you introduced Lovecraft into the conversation. Like you say, his horror is definitely informed by a fear and almost literal demonization of the other, a supernatural force in his fiction, but also in his life. Anyone who would have been described as swarthy in a 19th century novel. But then you also mention how a lot of the cosmic horror that helped develop as a genre had to do with this unknown not just being a thing that you experience in the moment, but also something that can change you after, your perception, your values, your baseline. This is a big part of the narrative of fear, especially when used as a social lever in our lives. Adam also notes how many of the cosmic horror narratives end with people, quote, going insane, which seems to him to be not so much a genuine concern for mental health as it is an extreme defensiveness about what we think about as what we know about the world. If destabilizing that idea is like the worst thing that can possibly happen to you. Adam goes on to say, but as probably many people who would have been described as maladaptive daydreamers, as kids know, sometimes what we quote know sucks and we're not satisfied with it. And this is where the unknown starts to seem more appealing. If the values we inherit seem like they're not serving us in any way, we start to get curious. That probably often manifests in people's lives more as an interest in non-mainstream political movements than it does in, say, discovering your place in your local spirit ecosystem or crossing Doth or whatever. But it's that curiosity that is important. And maybe you stop pitying Lovecraft's protagonist so much. Adam goes on to say that it also seems to me that this is a kind of subversive way to engage with Lovecraft's mythos. To do it from a place of curiosity and genuine interest rather than the fear and sometimes hatred he seems to feel. I can also enthusiastically recommend Clark Ashton Smith as being similar in content, tone, and verbiage to a lot of Lovecraft, but also some cool takes on more conventional fantasy tropes and far, far less racism. Adam also notes that I did not say the name of the Scottish play in the beginning of the episode, and also notes that he has not decided to type it. So cheers. I love this. There's a lot of great stuff to think about here. I do love the idea of taking this different take and approaching Lovecraft with more of a sense of curiosity rather than this fear. And Clark Ashton Smith sounds very refreshing, as I note in a response that I wrote to Adam. So thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. The last piece of listener mail or listener mail adjacent things that I want to share with you is something that was shared on the server recently. And I wanted to bring this up because I think it's just sort of an interesting topic of conversation about how we choose to contextualize ourselves and how we have these kinds of conversations in this new territory, this new digital territory in which we find ourselves. So thanks so much to Crossroads for allowing me to share this. So this is something that they had shared on a different platform and had ended up being temporarily banned from it because of it. And I'm not throwing any shade about that. I know it's very difficult to like moderate these digital spaces and stuff, and people have their rules and everything. But I do think that this is something that might be worth talking about, and I'd be interested to hear people's thoughts about it. Okay, so this is what Crossroads says to this other occult community. I see a lot of posts using the term baby witch lately, and also in comments here on this. It sort of seems at odds with actually practicing the craft and doing operational magic, which is focused on empowering yourself and your life in various ways. How you talk and think about yourself is important when leading a magical life. Calling yourself a baby witch seems to me like it removes working agency if you really believe that you are, quote, helpless as a baby would be, and have to rely on other people to tell you what to do in the craft or in magic. I feel like it's not talked about much, but part of improving your craft is shedding unhelpful views on how you see yourself. I'd say something like neophyte might be a better term. Maybe seeker. Something that doesn't infantilize you. I get being new to magic and witchcraft is a bit overwhelming, but keep in mind people have been doing it for thousands of years. While you might be new to it, there's a lot of history, books, and other things to draw on and learn from out there. Get out there. Learn. Do. Dare. There isn't an all-in-one guide for figuring yourself and your practice out. No one has all the answers. You do it and learn it as you go, supplementing with relevant material. Thoughts? Opinions? I welcome discussion. Okay, so thank you, Crossroads. I think this is a definitely interesting question to ask, and the reason that they gave you for banning you from this was that they were like, look, we don't like that you've, like, you're throwing shade on how people choose to talk about themselves, and, like, people should talk about themselves in whatever fucking way they want. I think that's fair, right? Like, people can call themselves whatever the fuck they want, baby, which I don't know, neophyte. But I do think it's an interesting thing to bring up, right? Like, it's, there's something to me about the term, which is, and I think that Crossroads kind of put their finger on this in saying that, like, we think about a witch as somebody that has a lot of agency and power, but then a baby is somebody that's, like, super helpless. So, it seems maybe just like an oxymoron or something. I'm really not sure. But I think that it circles back a little bit to something that Jason Miller brought up earlier in our conversation about this kind of idea that we have these different ways of like looking at the magical operant and how enfranchised or disenfranchised they are in the sort of culture in which they exist. And Jason brought up the idea of like the magician versus the witch, whereas the magician is, you know, somebody that we think of maybe as being a member of a royal's court
or somebody who has a lot of maybe influence behind the scenes, whereas the witch is somebody who really is existing on the periphery, perhaps, you know, on the edges of things. And as we talked about in the beginning of the episode too, somebody who might be, you know, pretty marginalized and hunted or whatever. In a lot of discussions I've had about this kind of like witch versus magician dichotomy, there are some gender things that come up obviously too. And so I think that it's interesting to think about this term baby witch and the idea of, and I know Crossroads brought this up in the thing about infantilization, and I don't know, I think it's just something worth thinking about. I don't necessarily have any like set opinions on it per se, but I do think it's an interesting thing to ponder. So fuck yeah. Okay. If you have ideas about that or anything that you would like to share for listener mail, please don't be shy. You can reach me at luxocultpod@gmail.com, or you can hit me up on Instagram at luxocultpod. If you're into the show and you would like to support it, word of mouth is huge. You can tell your friends, your lovers, your enemies, your frenemies, your family, and the parents of the Girl Scout troop selling cookies at their grocery store about it. You can also post about it on social media, give some positive reviews and stars or whatever, or support the show on Patreon to check out a bit of bonus content and take a bibliomancy break with me. There are no tiers or levels or whatever, so give as you will. Cheers and so much love to everybody who is already supporting it in that way. It is very much appreciated. Thank you. And on this theme of expressing thanks and gratitude, as I mentioned, the new album I'm going to be releasing probably later the same day that this episode comes out, if everything goes to plan. There's a few things I still have to iron out here. But anyway, as I said earlier, it's an offering of thanks to the goddess Hecate. While I tend to experience things in a pretty abstract manner, in working with her, I've definitely sometimes had the sense that I was maybe getting shades of what other people who really connect with gods or personifications of power or whatever in like a very literal way might experience. It's something that I've always been really curious about, just from watching people who are maybe like super religious or whatever. It just doesn't seem to like naturally compute for me. But that doesn't mean that I don't want to like learn how to go there and see what that's like. So, as I said, I've gotten some shades of this. And for me, experimenting in this territory with the personification of magic itself really tracks, because magic is one of the things that adds so much color and richness to life. The potential to have experiences of transcendence, experiences of awe. It's just something that I continually appreciate about the world in which we live, and I do think that magic is an integral part of that. Another thing that I appreciate is being able to share some of these experiences with others. Thank you for listening. Thanks to everybody who is participating in the Green Mushroom Project, regardless of what that looks like for you in your practice. Having the chance to connect with people and learn from people and to joke around or just be inspired by the cool things that people are up to is so fucking rad. Much love and mush love. There's a lot of cool stuff going on with the project. We are super excited to be recording the next installment of the Audio Grimoire, which is going to be happening later on this month. That'll probably be out, I'm guessing, sometime early in the new year. We will see how that goes. Maybe earlier, maybe later. Not sure 100%. As I said, we'll see how it goes. There are also plans to do more planetary spirituals led by Dave Audrey from the Unearthing Paranormalcy podcast. We are also planning to raise a group servitor or egregore or whatever you want to call it, which will be a helper for our new server. Yeah, we've got all kinds of fun ongoing things happening as well, like weekly chats and a book club and plans for a new divination club in the new year and much more. So if you are interested in coming and hanging out and participating in either the Green Mushroom Project or Administrism or both or neither, and you just want to talk about general chaos magic shit with some people who are super into it or whatever your frame of reference is, everybody's welcome as long as you're not an asshole.
hit me up and I will get you a link and you can come and check it out. Well, I guess in closing, I would say that the things which run in contrast to self-sovereignty are multifaceted and occur in many different dimensions in our lives. And wherever there is the opportunity to capitulate to the status quo because it's the easy thing to do or whatever, if it pleases us, we should joyously work to dismantle the systems of oppression wherever we find them, especially within ourselves. Remember to resist. Resist by maintaining sovereignty of the self. Resist by maintaining love of the self. Resist by maintaining fierce loyalty to love and pleasure. Resist with acts of radical kindness. Focus on the path to better times. Fuck yeah. Thanks so much to Jason Miller for joining me, and thanks so much to you for listening. This is Lex Estrada, reminding you to stay strong and stay fucking curious.
Lux Occult is a part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
I'm Steve.
And I'm Jason. And we're the hosts of an explorative podcast called Grognostics, where we mix in one part of curiosity, one part comedy, one part craft beer tastings, one part education, and yet one part fictional stories. Good Lord, that's a lot of parts.
Look, the show's really cool, okay?
I don't know, I'm not so sure now. Sounds more confusing than the time we came over early to your Christmas party last year and found you bawling your eyes out, pantless, mind you, to a Lance Bass Hallmark movie.
That was a phase, Jason. A phase, I tell ya.
Look, if you want to listen, grab a cold one and tune in on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You might even learn a thing or two.
That's Grognostics, Grognostics. Look, my pants are in the dryer. Lance just happened to be on.
Sure, buddy. Sure.
Welcome to XP Planet.
Greetings, friends, fiends, and lovers of strange and wondrous things. My name is Flood, and I am the host of XV Planets, a bi-weekly podcast of the odd and unusual. The core of XV Planets is a documentary-style exploration into paranormal investigations that I and my ever-evolving group of magical misfits conduct. We take a look at the history, the mystery, then go see it for ourselves, and then we bring that experience, and on occasion, that evidence, to your ears. Alongside the investigations, you'll find a treasure trove of other content, like interviews with authors, art historians, mediums, UFO researchers, cryptid hunters, fellow paranormal investigators, as well as deep dives into the arts, exploring topics like the Killing Joke frontman Jazz Coleman's magical practices and how that propelled the band forward, and whether or not David Lynch was really conducting occult rituals through Twin Peaks: The Return. So follow XV Planets today and get caught up on the journey, because I can promise you, it only gets stranger from here. I'll see you on the fifth plane.